Well, if there's one thing that's both fascinating and unnerving all at the same time, and I'm speaking for myself when I say that, fascinating and unnerving, it is our future presentation before God, otherwise known as the Judgment Day. Now, whether or not we talk about the Judgment Day, we can't escape it. It is a factual teaching of the gospel. In other words, if I never got up here and did a lesson on this, it doesn't make it go away one bit. And there's a lot of preachers out there in the religious world who avoid subjects like this just because they seem unpopular or upsetting, but that doesn't make it go away. So my philosophy is, if it teaches that, then let's just deal with that, okay? But let's deal with it practically and realistically and not simply in an emotionally disturbing way. The fact of the matter is, this event will be in your future. Whoever you are, it will be in your future. We are all going to confront God in this way, or He's going to confront us, however you see that. Many Christian preachers have used this Judgment Day as a means of sending fear and dread into the heart of sinners to prompt them to do something that they ought to do, or as well as for Christians to keep them from doing something they ought not to do. And so this falls into a category in bygone days of which was called the fire and brimstone lesson, and that's what it's familiarly going to be referred to as in those of you who are older know that. Well, it's true that the Judgment Day is a day of sorrow and regret and punishment, and that all that sorrow, regret, and punishment is real. It will not be the case for Christians who are faithful till death. That's a phrase that comes out of Revelation 2, verse 10, that Jesus tells the Christians in Smyrna to be faithful till death, and they will receive a crown of life. So on that day, for Christians, it will be a day of confirmation, a day of vindication, a day of celebration and triumph. In essence, it will be a day in which we know that we were right to have put our faith in Jesus Christ. Despite whatever the world said, despite all the those who contested it, despite all those who disagreed with us or possibly even persecuted us, we know, we will know at that time, that we were right to have put our faith in Christ. And that's really what Paul is getting at in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 6 through 10. I'm not going to read that whole passage there, but I invite you to read that on your own. 2 Thessalonians 1, verse 6 through 10, where he talks about it's only right that God would repay those who gave you persecution and who gave you all this grief here. And he talks there, or implies there, the second coming of Christ will be a fiery judgment against those who do not know God and those who do not obey the gospel of God. Those who do not know God doesn't mean those who could not have known God, but rather those who didn't have a relationship with God. And then those who did not obey could well be Christians who simply once made a commitment, but then simply did not follow through with that. And this is what he says at the end of all that. He says, when he comes to be glorified in his saints on that day and to be marveled at all among all who have believed, for our testimony to you was believed. That's just an interesting way of looking at it. Jesus will be glorified in his saints. Have you caught that before? So Jesus is coming in glory, but he will be glorified in his saints on that day. In other words, if we are faithful till death, then that means that we will be visible representatives of his triumph. We will be the actual witnesses or the actual testimony that this was the right thing to do. And that's what Paul is saying. Our testimony to you was believed and, quite honestly, should have been believed. Was right to have been believed, and even we will marvel at his presence. While we came to Christ in faith, he will come to us in fact. We will behold him at that time. He will smile upon us, he will welcome us, and he will take us home. And that's something that you should be having in your thoughts throughout the day. Not just all the doom and gloom and political rhetoric and all the nonsense going on in the world, the shootings, the chaos, the economic downturns and all the international foreign policy disasters. I mean, that's there. You can't escape that. But what you and I should be focusing on as Christians is all that is temporary and it is going to pass. And we ought to be looking beyond that and preparing for what is beyond that. For our testimony to you was believed. There is such a happy ending for as a result of that belief. And that's what Paul is saying. There's just nothing ugly or negative or terrifying about the judgment day for those who are genuine Christians. Unless, of course, you're not a Christian. We're not prepared to face that day, not living as a Christian ought to live. Every person in this room, in this society, in this world, makes his own choice about his eternal future. There's only one choice that leads to God. All other choices, and there are many of them, lead somewhere else, always to one's spiritual ruin. As John says in 1 John chapter 2, verse 17, the world and all of its desires and carnal lusts and everything else that's part of the world, by association or otherwise, is going to pass away, which is another way of saying that it's just not going to exist forever. Why would you put your stock in or even your fear in the world when in fact we don't need to do that? We ought to be putting our stock in what is beyond this world. We would do well to take this seriously. My intention in this lesson is not to scare anyone into believing, but to convince you that becoming a faithful Christian and living thereafter as a faithful Christian is the best decision that you could possibly make. It's the very best decision. For our message to you is to be believed. Well, let's just get to it, though. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, Paul says very clearly, he says, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he's done, whether good or bad. This is not limited to Christians. This is not limited to the church. This is really what everyone will do. We are all going to stand before the judge. This is powerful. This is sobering. This is awe-inspiring that no matter who we are, no matter what we have done, whether we chose to believe in Christ or not, or how faithful we were to Christ or not, or how we wasted our life in sin, nonetheless, all of us are going to stand before the judge. Again, that is a fact of Scripture. That is a fact of your future. That is a fact of your existence. Judgment Day, even though it's called a day, is really not a day at all. It's really an event, and it's not an event measured by time or hours, but by its importance to our personal existence. It is the culminating day to our existence. It is the transition day between this existence now and where we will exist thereafter. And it is a great day because it will occur on that great threshold of transition there, and it will occur upon the completion of two main criteria that God has used throughout Scripture, and that is, first of all, it will happen in the right order. God is a God of sequence, or sequential order, if you will. He always does things in a very process-oriented, methodical manner, very systematic. Things happen for a reason, but they also happen in the right order. This will be when it is most appropriate in that right order, after all other events leading up to it have been fulfilled. It will also happen then at the right time, referring not just to sequence, but also to conditions requiring this divine judgment to be fulfilled. And at the right time is an expression that actually comes out of Romans chapter 5, where it says that at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. God always operates at the right time, always in the right sequence, always at the right time. What these events and times and conditions are in their entirety, only God knows. But I want you to know that He does not act randomly or on purpose. There's always a master plan. He always operates by a divine schedule. He always has a final objective. So what I'm saying then is, really what the Bible is saying then, is that the judgment day is not going to just appear upon us without all these things being satisfied first. It will happen when God is good and ready for it to happen, is another way of looking at that. And not a moment too soon, not a moment too late, which is really answering the question of when. When God says enough to the present system. And this is not ducking the question, by the way, as to when. We're just simply admitting we don't know. The New Testament does not concern itself with the when question. as to when the end shall come, but continually implores us, be ready for or be prepared for that end, since you don't know when it's going to come. And that's exactly what 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10 through 12 says. He says, the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, the elements be destroyed with intense heat, the earth and its works be burned up. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you, Christians, to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking forward to and hastening that day? Not that you could make it come any quicker, but the idea there being that you're anticipating that time rather than dreading it like the rest of the world. So Peter's intention then is not to set a date for that event there, that time, nor to satisfy all our questions concerning us, but rather saying, what sort of people ought you to be, since it is sure to happen? I know as well as you do that discussions of Judgment Day are often lost in logistics, because then we start to apply literally how in the world, and I don't mean that literally in the world, but how in the world is God going to judge billions of people? How much time is that going to take? How long will that line be? You know, I mean, what are we going to see? What are we going to hear? Will everyone see? Will everyone hear? And there's a lot of those kinds of questions that we just don't know. The fact is, it is a great day that we don't know much about, and I truly believe, for what it's worth, that God has intentionally withheld information from us so that we didn't get all caught up in all those kinds of details to the neglect of what we should be focusing on, and that is being morally prepared for that day to come. We are told, and that was our reading here this morning, Revelation chapter 20, verse 11 through 15, we are told of this scene, which is symbolic in nature, but does depict an actual truth. John is in the middle of a vision when he sees this scene, so don't literalize what he says or sees there, but at the same time, he is describing to you, even in that visionary context, something that is real and authentic. And so what he sees then is the end of the physical realm, and he's seeing the end of human existence, and he's seeing the end of humankind in the physical realm. He's seeing that great judgment scene, which is that transition. Those who are judged to be faithful, their names will be in the book of life. Those who are judged to be either unfaithful or who never had a relationship with God, well, their end will be in another place. And you say, you know, how is that all going to happen? Well, that's really not relevant to our discussion or even something that we could answer with any certainty. The certainty is in the event itself. The certainty is knowing that that event is going to happen. It is going to happen. It is not an idle threat. It is not an empty promise. In essence, the great day is a day in which all that is hidden is going to be exposed and brought to light. Everything is going to be uncovered. Everything is going to be revealed. I think that's part of the unnerving part of it right there. Because right now, we can all have secrets, right? You don't know what I'm thinking right now. I don't know what any of you are thinking right now. Hopefully it's good. But anyway, I don't know. And so there's all these secrets. We withhold information from our spouses, from our friends, from our associates, even from those in the church. We try our best to hold information sometimes even from God. And what God is telling you is that you have the opportunity to at least think that you're withholding that information now and are successful when it comes to people, but there's going to come a time when all that information is going to come to light. And that is unnerving. It's liberating in one sense. It's terribly unnerving in another. Jesus says in John chapter 3, he says, everyone who does evil hates the light. Why? Well, because the light exposes us. It exposes us for what we really are. It also exposes what we're really thinking or what's really in our heart. That person does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light. We actually gravitate to that light because we want our deeds to be manifested as having come from God or being wrought in God, being made by God, really, as Paul says in Ephesians 2, verse 10, that we were made for the purpose of good works in his name. And so we really have nothing to fear if indeed we are righteous people. We are welcome to that light. In fact, we want to go and walk in that light. That's something to think about. And you know, Kevin was bringing that up in essence in his little discourse here on the table, that is really asking you to examine yourself. Are you walking in the light? Because you can walk in darkness right now and fool everybody, or you can just walk in darkness and not care what anyone thinks. The fact is, that's not going to help you. But if you're walking in the light, then you're going to be with God. And that's exactly what he wants. So every deed is going to be exposed, as is evident in the two scriptures I gave you already, 2 Corinthians 5:10, Revelation chapter 20, verse 11 through 15, and then this one here, Romans chapter 2, 6. It says the same thing consistently every time. Every deed, going to be exposed, brought to judgment there. Every word is going to be brought to judgment. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 12, your words will be judged, what you said will be judged. So we're finding our actions are judged, our deeds are judged, even our attitudes, our intentions, our motives will be judged, because all the secrets of men will be judged as well. Romans chapter 2, verse 16. Well, that takes care of everything, doesn't it? That takes care of our visible behavior. That takes care of the things that we say. It also takes care of what's in our heart. What he's saying then, or what they are saying, all the writers are saying the same thing through a common spirit. They are saying that our entire being is going to stand before God and be judged. That will be a great day when that happens. Great because we will be brought before the throne of God and the throne of Christ, surrounded by the hosts of heaven. But it will also be great simply in the fact of our meeting God. I can't think of a future event that is more, as I said before, fascinating and frightening all at once. And I stand before you as, I believe, a Christian who is in favor with God, and yet, even having said that, I am fearful of standing before someone that powerful, because I've never stood before anyone that powerful. Even though I believe that he's going to save me, still I know what his power is capable of doing. It's capable of destroying me. And that's just something to think about there. This is unlike any experience here that we could even imagine on earth. God is not just a powerful being. He is the highest authority that exists, period. There isn't a higher authority. It's not like, well, there's God, but then there's, you know, something above or someone above him. He is the limit. And that says a lot about his power, his authority, his majesty, his supremacy, his sovereignty, and all those other words that really define his attributes as a God. He is capable of speaking things into existence. He rules over all creation. He made all of creation. He is over every power, every authority, every principality. He has the power to save despite whatever we have done against him. He still has the power to save us, but keep in mind, he also has the power to destroy us. So when the Bible talks about having a fear of God, yes, there is reverence. That's part of that fear. But let's also have that healthy respect for exactly who we are dealing with. So if you're one of those people, and I don't know anyone who is here, but if you were one of those people that's just kind of playing with your religion, just playing with your profession of faith, that's trying to make everyone think that you're doing something, but really, you know in your heart, you're not. And you're sitting there lying to God and telling God stories and trying to make up stuff that isn't right and isn't real. Do you really understand who you're dealing with, is what I'm asking you. You're not dealing with some person who doesn't know you and can't know you and will never know you, absolutely. You're dealing with someone who already knows you better than you know yourself. And he was going to call every single one of those things that you're doing right now to judgment and say, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Or it might be more like this. This is what you did. This is what you did. Because I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of conversation at that time. This day will be great in scope. It is a day that transcends time. It transcends all physical space, the material world, physical life, everything that you and I are familiar with in this world. Is the culmination of human history, not just world history, but also your history. It is the culmination of your history as you have put together by your existence here on this earth. All the things that you did, said, thought, everything. How you spent your time while you as Dick often says, walked upon the face of this earth, right, Dick? And that's something to reckon with right there, is how am I spending my time? What am I doing? What does my history look like? What am I putting together? How am I packaging myself here? And how is God looking at all of this? It will certainly be great in its justice, also in its fairness. Everyone always says, well, we want God to be just. We want God to be fair. Be careful what you ask for. Because God most certainly will be just and he will be fair. And if you're on the wrong end of that justice, well, then he's going to be just, you know, to your ruin. Paul says it this way. There will be tribulation and distress for every soul of man who does evil, the Jew, also the Greek. But glory and honor and peace to everyone who does good, to the Jew, also to the Greek. For there is no partiality with God. Just think about what's being said. No partiality. That's something unknown in this world. Because in this life, everyone has partiality. I'm guilty of it. You're guilty of it. We all subjectively, personally want to favor some people over another or disfavor some people over others because of our standing with them, our relationships, or maybe our own self-motives, our agendas, whatever it is. We've got this infusion of subjectivity and partiality into everything that we do. God has none of that. Because God is able to remove himself from all of those emotional and personal situations and look at things as they really are. And therefore, he will not be swayed or bribed or intimidated or hoodwinked by anyone. Now, people think that they can fool God into believing something that is not true or believing that they are something that they're not. But then it will be obvious that that system never really worked in the first place. Wouldn't it be good to learn that right now while you have opportunity to change that system rather than to learn it then when you're just filled with absolute horror and regret? This day will be great in its separation. Not only is this separation from this life made final and complete, but also there will be relationships of this life that will be separated. Friends will be separated from friends. Spouses will be separated from their spouses. Children from their parents, parents from their children, even congregations will be separated by one's faithfulness over another's unfaithfulness. Not only this, but the wicked will be forever separated from the righteous. Right now, we have to coexist. If you're a wicked person and another person's a righteous person, well, you have the opportunity to exist together, but that righteous person will not have to exist with the wicked forever. There is a time coming when that separation will be made and it will be final. Not only this, but also the weaknesses and the vanity, the frustrations, the disappointments, all the shortcomings of this life will be forever separated from the power and the greatness and the triumph and the celebration of the life to come. And of course, I'm speaking if you are a Christian. In other words, you're not going to enter into heaven with all your baggage. Someone has said, every time we baptize someone, we baptize all their baggage too. And there's a lot of truth to that. But we're not going to be entering into heaven with all our baggage. All that gets left here. When you die, everything else stays. Except for the memory of your deeds, the record of your deeds, your words, and your thoughts. Those things will be brought to judgment. But all your other things, all your issues, all your preferences, all your idiosyncrasies, all those things that are particular to you in this life, they're all going to stay here in this life. And you're going to be separated from those things. Those are of the first things, new things, God says, have come. And speaking from that future perspective, this day will be great in its finality. The decisions, the conclusions, the sentencing will be binding. It will be irrevocable. There is not going to be, as you see today, a court of appeals. There's not going to be all kinds of judges that you can appeal to that will re-weigh your case and re-decide. There's not going to be any lawyers. There's not going to be any loopholes. There will be no technicalities or dismissal because of technicalities. There will be no exemptions. There will be no exceptions. There will be nothing overlooked, no one forgotten. That's a pretty remarkable day, which is why we call it the Great Day. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 7 says that the present heaven and earth, referring to our physical system, are being reserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. This great day will render due justice toward those who are ungodly, specifically toward those who, whether they knew it or not, or admitted it or not, followed Satan. They swallowed the lies and the deception that Satan gave them. They took his mark, so to speak. They refused the truth. And therefore, Jesus says, Matthew 25:41, and John and all other New Testament writers that comment on this, they will suffer with him as well. Satan is going to be destroyed, and those who followed him will be destroyed along with him. Those whose name is not found in the book of life, therefore not known by Jesus, and we're talking about relationship here or the absence of it. They had no relationship, no fellowship with Jesus. Those people, we're told, are going to be cast out. That's what Jesus says in Matthew, chapter 7, verse 21 through 23. Even among those who think that they're faithful, or, you know, didn't we not do all these great things in your name? And Jesus says, well, if we don't have a relationship, then I don't know who you are. That doesn't mean that Jesus literally doesn't know who they are, because Jesus knows everyone and everything. But it means that we don't have fellowship, and you're not going to be with God if you don't have fellowship with him. Or those who, through their own neglect or procrastination or laziness or indifference, forfeited the gospel call. In other words, for one excuse or another. And that's all they are, is just excuses. If the gospel call calls you, if you hear it and you forfeit that, and we're talking about as a pattern, as a chronic habit, you hear it, you hear it, you hear it, you forfeit, you forfeit, you forfeit, well, eventually you're going to give up all opportunity to be saved. Which is to say that you will be lost. And there are those who heard that gospel call, responded to it, obeyed it, and then fell away from that. What an awful thing to do. One thing I tell people, in almost every case anyway, I get opportunity, is don't make this decision to follow Christ if you're just thinking about it. Okay? Or if you are going to just try Jesus for a while or something like that, like people say. If you're going to make this decision, understand it is lifelong, it is binding, it is irrevocable, which means that it's better not to become a Christian than to become one and to fall away, which is what 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 20 through 22 actually says. But in Hebrews 10, verse 26 and 27, the writer here says, if we go on sinning willfully, and he's talking to Christians, by the way, we go on sinning willfully after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but rather a terrifying expectation of judgment. This is those who turn their back on their commitment made to the Lord, which is really the premise, or the assumed premise of the entire book of Hebrews, assumed in the sense of we assume that there are people who are ready to turn their backs on the Lord, and the writer says, you should not do that. Those who, as I cited earlier in 2 Thessalonians 1, do not know or do not obey the Lord, those who are willfully ignorant, they've chosen to be ignorant about God, that's those who did not know. And then those who did not obey, those are just simply those who knew better but just didn't do it. These will pay the price or the penalty of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord and the glory of his power. That's a quote from 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9. I'm bringing this up here to show you that, yeah, we're not trying to avoid the fact that there's an ugly side to this judgment day scenario. A very negative thing in the sense that, you know, there's so many people, and this is the majority, the largest percentage of all those who live on earth are going to really suffer this end here. And again, not because God made them that way, but because they chose to be this way. That's the sad fact. And it might sound like we're gloating over this, like, yeah, we're glad that they're going to suffer and pay that price. No, our appeal, and we're making that appeal even in this lesson, our appeal is to save souls while there is still time to do so. We're not gleefully anticipating the ruin of anyone's soul. In fact, I have to tell you, just even though I know people make their own decisions and I realize that that's their choice and so on, I don't like to hear of anyone who dies outside of the Lord, Because I know what's going to happen to that person, at least through what is instructed here. I know that they're not going to have another opportunity. I know that they've given up all opportunity, that they are facing an awful sentencing. I know that they're going to face an awful future. Why would I gleefully anticipate that or gloat over something like that? That's entirely unchristian to do so. But at the same time, and I'm not contradicting myself when I say this, at the same time, everyone makes their own choice, and those who stubbornly resist the message of hope that is paid for with nothing short of the blood of God's own Son, if you reject that, resist that, forfeit that, if you do that persistently, consistently, for the rest of your life and never come to obey Christ, well, then you get what you deserve. You get what you literally deserve. You get God's justice. Not grace and mercy, because that's only found through Christ. You get just cold, hard justice. Isn't that what everyone says they want? We just want justice. Well, be careful, as I said, what you ask for. Because if you're not right with God, that's all you're going to get is justice. That's not my message. And that's not our message here. That is Christ's message. That is the apostles' message, which means that's the message of the Holy Spirit, which means that's God's message. That's what he's saying. Take that very seriously. It is he who says this, and it's he who promises to fulfill this. In this life, as you should know by now, mercy and grace are available through the cross of Christ. In the afterlife, there is no more mercy, there is no more grace. We're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 23 through 25, for example, that the second coming, which is implied in that statement there, signals what Paul calls the end. The end of what? Well, the end of all opportunity to be saved through the redemption of Jesus Christ. To the redeeming opportunity. There's no more opportunity for the wicked in the end. There's no more struggle for the righteous once the end comes. So it'll be a tragedy for those who forfeit that opportunity. But while the great day represents darkness and gloom for the ungodly, it's just the opposite for Christians. And this is where I want to leave this lesson as we go forward. I'm not done yet, okay? But I want to certainly want to leave on this positive note here. Say, the great day is going to be great because, well, Satan and his angels, the source of our temptation, our enticement to do evil, will be removed and destroyed. He who lied to us, he who deceived us, he who tempted us, he who made our lives so difficult, he who made our faith so difficult, he is going to suffer and no longer be able to do what he's been doing all along so far. The saints who overcome will be victorious, while the one who tried to ruin us himself will be humiliated and ruined, never to come out of that ruin to hurt us again. Secondly, justice will be rendered for our having suffered loss or ridicule or even persecution for the sake of Christ. We have not been persecuted in this country so much, Christians. We've suffered loss and ridicule, perhaps. We have not shed blood. We have not been persecuted. That may change in the days to come. But for right now, you have to understand that there are many people, men and women both, throughout history and throughout even the present age right now in other countries who are suffering physically, legally, materially, if you will, through the deprivation of the things that they ought to have or certainly that we take for granted. They are suffering for the name of Christ. And there is going to be a time when that suffering will be compensated. In 2 Thessalonians 1, once again, it says that Jesus will give retribution. Well, that's a word that means compensation or revenge or payment. Really, in that case, spiritual death to those who caused all that in the first place, who never came to their senses, who never obeyed Christ. But in Matthew 5, verse 10 through 12, it says that we'll be blessed when we are persecuted, insulted, slandered for the name of Christ. Jesus says, your reward in heaven is great. Those are his words. And that will happen. That great reward will be given on the great day when all that reward is meted out. Thirdly, we will be vindicated for our faith, for the preaching of the gospel. We will be acquitted of the accusations of unbelievers. We will be exonerated by God himself. We're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 8, that the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. In other words, they refer to it or regard it as something that is foolish or useless or just silly or contemptible. But nonetheless, it is to us who are being saved the power of God. We're going to see that power of God exercised on our behalf visibly in front of all our enemies someday. And that's a great thing, that God will vindicate us himself. The book of Revelation is a vindication of the gospel and all believers against the forces of Satan. The triumphant in the end will be those who will stay the course and not fall away, but will overcome through their faith. So I want you to make this personal. All those who are resisting and refusing and rejecting your own preaching to them. Maybe you've got family members you've been talking to, or friends, or people have left you because you talked to them about the gospel, who forsook you and just gave up their friendship with you. All those people are going to be called for their actions, if indeed they have not become Christians by the time they reach that judgment day. Just think about that. You're going to be vindicated. They will be given justice. You will be given vindication. I'm not saying that that's what we want in the sense of we want to gloat once again over their demise. That's not it. But if that's the decision that they made and they stuck with it, well, then once again, they get what they deserve. So make that personal. They're going to see you being honored, and they will know that they were wrong. They will know that you were right to make the decision you made, and that they should have made that decision themselves. Keep that in the back of your mind when you're talking with people and you see that surly, contemptible, that religion, that Christianity, that nonsense, whatever they say. Keep that in mind, that you know that what you're preaching is right, what you're saying is true. There'll be vindication of our personal motives and character. Sometimes we are condemned, even though we are in the right. On the great day, our secret motives will be revealed. We will be vindicated, cleared of any wrongdoing. That's really what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4, 5, that on that judgment day, the Lord will bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. That means your heart, as well as those who contested you. So God will praise us if indeed we acted righteously. Most of all, for the righteous, the great day will be the turning point in our existence. Not the end of our existence, but rather the transition into something better than we've ever had or known until then. Our faith will be made fact. Right now we live in faith, we walk by faith, we exercise faith, but that faith is going to be made fact, or factual, or realized. And then we will hear God say to us, enter in, good and faithful servant, if indeed we have been good and faithful and servants in this world. Those words mark the beginning of an endless life of goodness and light and hope. We want to visualize Christ saying to the Father, this one belongs to me. And the angels and the hosts of heaven ushering you from the throne scene into this grand life with God, being received by all those who have already been ushered in. What a great thought. What a great scene to think about. Remember all the nonsense and garbage that's going on in the world. This is something that you can have in your heart that is real, that is potential. In other words, it's not just, something that's some kind of pie-in-the-sky dream or fantasy. This is something that can be yours if you are faithful to God. In fact, God promises, he guarantees it will be yours if you are faithful to him. All the troubles and heartaches and separations of this life and this earth are gone. The first things will have passed away. The great day is the last time that we'll ever have to see our enemies again. After that, we will meet with the redeemed by the river of life. We'll no longer be troubled by sin or with sin. We'll be filled with glory. We'll be filled with joy. We'll be filled with God's love. Why aren't there more people that want to believe in this? Because the alternative is so, so ugly and frightening. And actually, those who say that there's some other kind of heaven really have no basis for saying such things. 1 John chapter 4, verse 16 and 17 says that we have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this, love is perfected with us so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment. Just think about that. It's powerful. When we immerse ourselves in the love of God, which of course requires obedience to His commandments, then we can have confidence in that great day and in anticipation of that great day. We don't have to live in fear. In fact, Christians ought not to live in fear. And we don't have to wonder if, and we don't have to cross our fingers on our deathbeds and go, I hope I made the right decision. What a horrible time to be doubting, right? I mean, you should know. You should have confidence. We can know. We can have confidence. And while the atheists and the rebellious and the enemies of God are all cowering in fear, we can stand with confidence and assurance and have a living hope. While for some the great day marks the virtual end of their existence, for us it marks the beginning of our eternity with God. It is great for us in that way. But one thing's for certain, regardless of what you do or believe or don't do or don't believe, one thing is for certain, there is a great day that's coming. And there's nothing that you can do to stop it, nothing you can do to slow it down. Nothing you can do to escape or exempt yourself from it. There's nothing you can do. Over and over, God in the Scriptures is saying, prepare to meet your God. And through Jesus Christ, we are actually able to prepare to meet our God. And He wants us to meet Him in joy, in celebration, not in horror and recoiling and fear. He wants us with Him. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 2, I'll leave you with this thought. God says, at the acceptable time, I listened to you. On the day of salvation, I helped you. Behold, now is the acceptable time. Now, today, is the day of salvation. What I'm telling you is what Paul is saying, is why would you wait when something so great, so momentous, so affecting your entire existence looms on the horizon and you have no idea when you're going to appear before that judge? Wouldn't you do well to be ready for that time? Prepare now while you have time to do so, because I don't know how much more time you have. We have seen that we live in a fragile, volatile, transitory world. Nothing's guaranteed here. But God guarantees your future. Put your trust in Him. Do what you need to do. If you're ready to be baptized into Christ this morning, then what's stopping you? If you know what to do and you're ready to do it, ready to commit to that, then what's stopping you? Be prepared while you have time. As we stand and sing the song that Richard